Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. What would zero waste look like, and how possible is it? This hour in The Exchange, as part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Project, we look at practical ways to slash your trash. And listeners, send us your experiences, ideas, and questions by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Now, one huge source of trash in our landfills, oceans, and in our communities is plastic. And we're going to talk first about why that's the case. Joining us now is Laura Sullivan, NPR reporter who, with PBS Frontline, spent months investigating the role of oil and gas companies back in the 1970s promoting plastics recycling. And Laura Sullivan, a big welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for those that haven't read your report, just to let them know, you read through countless boxes of company documents. You interviewed a whole bunch of top former plastic industry officials. And you concluded, Laura, that the industry for a long time promoted recycling to the public, knowing it didn't work. When did this take place and why, Laura?
So we begin to ask the sort of basic question that I think a lot of people have had for years now about, you know, what's happening when you throw your stuff into the blue bin, or what happens when you're walking through the airport and you're like, okay, I'll put it in the recycling thing, but you look in and it's really all gross and trash and you're not sure what's happening. And so we at NPR, along with a lot of people, especially after China stopped taking the trash, looked around and said, let's take a look at recycling. And we found what most people were finding is that there really aren't markets for this stuff, that, you know, very at the end of the day, less than 10% of all plastic has ever been recycled. And that's even with China buying the stuff. So the question that came up for me was, how come we didn't know that? I mean, I grew up with all of these ads in the 90s. I grew up understanding that all plastic could be recycled and turned into something else, and that this was really possible. And you know, I was one of these recyclers who threw everything in, saying, well, I'm sure somebody's sorting it out, or it's such a big chunk of plastic, somebody wants this, it's so valuable. And, you know, I am, you know, more people recycle in this country than vote. So it was just part of our lives, and it has been for years. And the question I had was, if this isn't working, why did we all think that this was working? And if it's not working now, has it ever worked? And I think that that led us on this journey to figure out why we all believed something that wasn't true. And that, the biggest question of all, was really that if this wasn't true, who told us it was? And that led us to the oil and gas company. So we ended up tracking down over almost a year at this point, dozens of officials who used to work in the industry or just on the periphery of the industry, and then went in search of some of the documents from that time. And so we went up to Syracuse University and the Hagley Library at the DuPont Archives, looking for their own documents. And what we found in these archives were just document after document showing how difficult, how expensive, how problematic plastic recycling is in a way that metals recycling is not. And you know, what you really see is just that it's just, you know, the virgin oil that you can make plastic bags out of or anything else plastic out of is so cheap that you can't get around this sort of foundational problem that it's cheaper and easier to make it out of virgin oil. And even when you do take a really solid, good plastic, like a PET soda or water bottle, you know, they have the best numbers of all, with 30% being recycled. And the majority of those are just getting recycled once because plastic degrades. So really, you're just talking about a momentary stop before you end up in the landfill. And I think that what was most shocking in these documents was that the oil and gas industry knew this all along.
Well, what were some of the comments made, Laura, that showed you that they were well aware this wasn't going to work?
Yeah. So, I mean, they called recycling plastic, you know, the sorting of it infeasible. They said it was, you can't, there's no recovery from obsolete products was one of the documents that was sent to top oil executives in the 70s. There was a speech that was given where they said it was unlikely that plastic recycling will ever be economically viable. And that was given to top, you know, plastic, a private, you know, top gathering, and you know, to the very, this is the head of Exxon, this is the head of Chevron, these are the, you know, Procter and Gamble, Dow, DuPont, their top executives. And so what we did is went in search of the people who were there, and we ended up getting three of their top officials on the record who said that what this was they put in this at the same time that they're getting all these, this information, and their own scientists are saying this, there's all these ads on the air that I grew up with, you know, plastic is amazing, recycle your plastic, you can do it, you know, school recycling contests and all these expensive benches outside of grocery stores that don't make any economic sense. And they were funding recycling machines that didn't make any sense. And, you know, all of this stuff. And so I asked some of them, like, why did you tell Americans to recycle when you knew that plastic recycling was unlikely to work on an economic, you know, on a vast scale? And I, you know, the one guy who was the top lobbyist for the oil and gas industry said, because if the public thinks that recycling is working, they will not be as concerned about the environment.
Yeah, you just squish the bottle and put it in the recycling bin, which is exactly kind of what I do all the time.
More plastic.
Right. I feel fine, right?
Totally. And the 90s were such an interesting time too, because even though people were embracing plastic and using it and loving it, and it's a chemical marvel, this thing. But at the same time, there were these sort of anti-plastic advocates, kind of like you see now. And they were saying, there's too much trash. We can't have all this trash. This is not good for the environment. We can't have it in our rivers, and it doesn't decompose, and it's going to survive for hundreds of years. And we can't have all this plastic trash. This is insane. And so they were pushing plastic bans, just like you see now. And this was really what these insiders were telling us, is that this push to sort of get the public to wrap their brain around all plastic can be recycled and this is amazing was really a way to sell more plastic and to push back on those bans and say, don't ban plastic. Plastic can be recycled. And there was some hope. A couple of the men, they were all men at that time, were saying, you know, we really hoped it might work. You know, there was one guy, Ron Leesmer, who was sent out to get plastic recycling into neighborhoods, into homes, the curbs, the bins, and all this stuff. They went out to Minnesota and New York and places where these bans were popping up. And he said that, you know, they really tried. He really sort of hoped that they would get recycling launched and off the ground, and sort of magically maybe the economics of it all would work out. And he said that he found what everybody else found, that at the end of the day, there was just too many different kinds of plastic. I mean,
well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, Laura, because I have an email from Bob in Washington, New Hampshire, not DC. I'm continually frustrated, Bob says, trying to actually read the recycling codes on plastic containers. Mm-hmm. They are often very, very small, very difficult to read, Bob says. Our transfer station only recycles types 1 and 2. All others go to the landfill. Bob says, I'd like to see product plastic packaging mandated by law to have easily readable identification as to the type of plastic. I'd also like to see the types of plastic that are not recyclable clearly identified as such. Bob, I hear you. It would be so nice for me, Laura, to have that, you know, juice bottle say not recyclable. Or not recyclable in most places, but they're not going to do
which
that.
There's this little, which is the truth for the vast majority of all plastic that Bob is handling. Here's a little story about the recycling codes. So some of the documents talked a lot about. I found a lot of documents about the recycling codes and tracked down some of the people involved in that. And you know, those did not end up on plastic because it was supposed to be like helpful environmentally or to help Bob and everybody else and me recycle. The codes were put on plastic, according to the industry documents, to make the public think that plastic was recyclable, even when it wasn't economically recyclable. And what I found was a very quiet and very strong push in the early 90s, where the oil and gas industry lobbied almost 40 states to mandate that this code be put on the bottom of plastic containers. It's the international recycling symbol with a number in the middle. And they said that, you know, when I interviewed them, they said, well, this was meant to help sort plastic. We really want to help the recyclers sort plastic. But there was an entire consortium of recyclers out there that said, stop putting the symbol on this plastic. Everybody's throwing everything in the bins. We only want soda bottles and milk jugs. We don't care what number you're putting on inside a recycling symbol. Stop it. And they fought for years against the industry, saying you're making this more confusing to people than it is. It doesn't need to be this confusing. We just want soda bottles and milk jugs. And the industry fought back for years and they didn't budge, and it lasted for almost 30 years. And to this day, the public is turning over bottles looking for this recycling symbol, thinking that it tells them something valuable when it doesn't. Most recyclers on a sorting line, they can't tell the difference between a 2 and a 4 and a 1. They all look like clear plastic, and there's plenty of, you know, jugs that use a 3, you know, there's all types of different plastic. And just because it says 1 doesn't mean that it's the kind of particular plastic that they want for the milk jug or for the soda bottles.
Well, so I think most people just throw it in no matter what the number is. I don't even think most people, I mean, good for you, Bob. I think most people don't even look at the number.
Yeah, right? They see the.
Laura, you still there? Laura, you still there? Oh, it sounds like we lost our reporter, Laura Sullivan. It gives me a chance to remind listeners that we are talking about zero waste today on The Exchange, and specifically focusing on plastic recycling right now with NPR reporter Laura Sullivan. And Laura, you're back with us. So go ahead. I was just saying, I think most people don't even look at the numbers. They just chuck it in the bin.
They just chuck it in the bin. And when you look at these documents, the oil industry and gas industry and the plastic industry knew this all along. They received a report in the early 1990s that said to the top industry executives, the code is being misused. It says, you know, this is being used as a greenwashing tool. It's suggesting to people that plastic is recyclable in ways that it is not. And the industry had that report. They knew that it went to the very tippy top of all these companies, and they kept doing it anyway. And a lot of the recyclers said, you know, look, like, they're doing this because they want people to believe plastic is recyclable. At the end of the day, people in sorting centers cannot tell the difference between what they're looking at. They have less than a second to throw something in one direction or the other, or a very expensive machine can do it, but these very expensive machines, there's just not a lot of money to be made in used plastic. So you're counting on the public to want used plastic. You know, there's a, you know, Pepsi and Coke are under a lot of pressure to use recyclable content in their bottles. But what happens in 5 years? What happens in 20 years when we're not talking about this anymore? How is that sort of pressure from the public gonna be maintained?
Well, in the course of your reporting, Laura, you looked at all these documents and talked to former industry officials, but you also talked to current plastics industry officials who said, you know, I'm quoting here, truly, this is not PR. We really want people to recycle. Another one said there's different technology on the horizon that will give us a different outcome. So how do you view these claims, Laura?
So I sat down with the head of sustainability for Chevron Phillips, and he said that he would that their plan, because I asked them, what are you going to do now? You know, what's going on now? And he said, we're going to recycle 100% of the plastic we make by 2040. 100%.
Wow.
And we've, at 30 years into recycling, we've never really gotten past 9. And that's with China open. This isn't even like looking at the numbers after China closes its doors. And I said, how on earth are you going to get to 100%? He said, well, we really, really care this time. And we're going to spend a lot of money this time. And we're really going to get people to, we're going to do lots of new technology. We have new machines coming out. We're going to chemically recycle things, which has never been sort of viable in 10 years yet. And he was very earnest. He, you know, he told a story about vacationing with his wife, and he was so upset about all the trash, the plastic trash they saw, and that this was all landing in the wrong place. And he was very earnest about this. But, you know, and he said, we really are going to spend a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars we're going to spend on this. And then I went and I talked to the head of the head, you know, spokesperson for the entire gas and oil and plastic industry. And he said, yes, that's our vision too. We're going to recycle it all by 2040. But the problem is that there's more plastic trash than there's ever been. it is harder to recycle now because there's a gazillion different kinds. There's hundreds, there's 800 and some, in some cases, even more different types of plastic. Everybody's using layers of plastic. And on top of that, the cost of virgin oil is still cheaper. So it's just cheaper and easier to use new oil than it is to use plastic trash to make plastic things. And then there's this sort of really foundational problem that if the oil and gas industry uses 100% of all of the plastic trash to make new plastic items, why would anybody need to buy their oil and gas? And it's hard to see the oil industry putting itself out of business like that. They said, no, you misunderstand. There's always going to be a need for even more. We're going to recycle everything we have, and we're going to use all new virgin oil for even more plastic products. And at this point, plastic production is expected to triple by 2050. So by the time you get to, think about how much plastic is in your life right now and triple it, right, at this point. And, they said that this is not public relations. And I went back and I asked, all the guys that I had talked to in the 90s, and I played the industry's new commercial, which is going on right now in the same way that the 90s. And they said, it's exactly the same. They said they didn't believe it. They said that this is just the same story that they told in the 90s, get the public to believe that recycling plastic will work and people will stop talking about the environmental problems with plastic.
So I have to ask you this last question, Laura, and it's a more personal one. So again, I buy stuff from the grocery store. A lot of it comes in plastic. I squish it. I put it in the bin. Should I not bother?
Soda bottles and milk jugs. That's the only thing I found in this country at this moment right now that has an actual viable market. And even then, it's depending on people wanting recycled content in their products. So we'll see if it lasts. But the recyclers I talk to, note 3 through 7, if you are going to flip them over, there's no U.S. market for 3 through 7s right now. Overseas markets are really sketchy. I went to Indonesia. It was like walking through a grocery store in these people's neighborhoods. It was just all the stuff that Americans were putting in their blue bins, getting dumped into people's neighborhoods and into the oceans.
Oh my gosh.
I go into the grocery store and I look at my own cart and I feel nothing but defeat. And at this point for me, and this is just me based on the experience I had doing this story, is that I recycle those two things and I make sure the rest of it goes into the landfill and won't be in any way landing in somebody's neighborhood or in the ocean.
Well, and as you talk about your own grocery cart, that's a perfect segue to our next guest. So Laura Sullivan, I'll let you go for now. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Laura Sullivan, NPR reporter. You can find her report about plastics recycling on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So listeners, for the rest of the hour, we are talking about zero waste, or at least reducing your own waste stream, whether your trash bin or your recycling bin. We have two guests with us for the rest of the hour. They are Ryan Visda. She's administrator of Zero Waste New Hampshire's Facebook page and also co-owner of Bonafide Green Goods. That's a store in downtown Concord focused on waste reduction. And also with us, Christy Petchy, director of the Zero Waste Project for the Conservation Law Foundation. Well, welcome to both of you. And let's just reflect on what we just heard from Laura Sullivan. And Kirsty, you first, how much has the focus on recycling, go ahead and buy it, you can just recycle it, taken away from the messages that you and Ryan focus on, which is reduce, reuse? Go ahead, Kirsty.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the only thing that the oil, gas, or plastic industry are recycling are their media spots, their advertising, right? So they're not, the plastic is not going to get recycled. And I 100% agree with everything that Laura Sullivan did. Her article is fantastic if you haven't read it yet, really informative. And that's the truth. That being said, we do have, recycling and our goods, there are some steps. We need to, first of all, actually be capturing those materials, so they have to be in the bin. Then we have to sort them. Then we have to make them into a new product. That's what real recycling is, right? Is making it into a new product. The American Chemistry Association and the oil and gas companies want to do what they call chemical recycling now, which is burning, mostly burning these materials. Maybe a little bit gets made into new plastic, but as Laura so aptly put it, if we recycled all the plastic, there'd be nothing else to do with all this oil and gas and they'd go out of business. So we have to understand that the reality is plastic is not going to get recycled. It's dangerous from beginning to end. Fracking gas, refining gas and oil, making it into plastic, recycling plastic, burning plastic and landfilling plastic are all dangerous. And there are public health consequences to all those steps, as well as using plastic is dangerous. So we want to avoid the plastic. We want to minimize what we're doing. And as she also said, we want to recycle number one and number two plastic, the soda bottles and the milk jugs. That being said, as we'll get into, there's a lot you can do, not only in your own home, but a lot you can do in your community to change this paradigm. We don't have to do what the oil companies and what the plastic companies want us to do. We can push back and we can take action.
We'll get into reducing waste this hour. We started off by talking about this recycling plastic conundrum with Laura Sullivan. For the rest of the hour, I'm hoping we can get ideas and questions and practical suggestions for reducing what's going into our trash and our recycling bins. And Ryan, I wanted to turn to you too, but with an email from Julian Spofford, who says, I believe that the push to recycling has possibly done more harm than good, Julie says. It allows people to feel like they are doing their part, when if they really want to see a change in the environment, they need to stop consuming so much to begin with. And since our economy is based on consumption, our government and manufacturers are not going to want to make this easy for people to do. And Julie, thank you for writing. And Ryan, what do you think?
I agree with Julie. I think there's five R's of being zero waste. And the first one is refuse. And you just have to go through your day and think about all the times that you're being told to buy something because it's easy. And then as soon as you're done with it, it just goes away. But there is a place where it goes. And as we're seeing it's ending up in a village across the world where people are just living surrounded by trash and it's burning. Like, it's not just going away to recycle into a fancy doormat. It's actually impacting people's lives around the world. So that first step is refuse and taking a hard look at how you're consuming and what you're consuming and starting to go item by item and be like, how can I change this item in my life and not bring it in or get it in a way that doesn't come wrapped in plastic or in a material that has to go away.
Well, Michael in Dover wrote in with some suggestions. He says, here's some quick and easy suggestions to reduce waste. Use cloth bags instead of plastic. Ask your bagger not to use plastic bags and just put your stuff in the shopping cart and you can put it in your car yourself. Use reusable lunch bags, Michael says, and buy in bulk using reusable containers. So Ryan and Kirsty, after a break, I want to ask you about reusable containers, buying in bulk. I have read that because of the pandemic, some people are shying away from that. They're worried about what they perceive to be the germ factor. So definitely coming up, we're going to talk about how the pandemic has affected the way we approach our trash and recycling bins and this whole reusable movement. We will be right back and we'll keep taking your suggestions as well. It's exchange at nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477.
Nobody deserves to be hungry, and we've got the opportunity to change that.
Eileen Laponis is the executive director of the New Hampshire Food Bank, a longtime partner of NHPR.
Well, much like NHPR, we have a responsibility to reach every corner of the state. We're trying to further our impact and not just feed the hunger, but nourish the health. And together we do that.
Become an NHPR sustainer today at $13 a month and choose to give 13 meals to help feed local families in need at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, getting to zero waste, or at least doing more to cut your trash and recycling streams. It's part of NHPR's Bi-Degrees Climate Reporting Project. And listeners, let's hear from you. How has the pandemic affected your trash and recycling bins? Do you find yourself throwing out less or more? And what ideas do you have in your own household for waste reduction? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Ryan Vizda and Kirsty Petchy. And both of you, let's go to our listeners. Steve in Nottingham is calling in. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you very much for this show. And I'm reminiscent of the movie The Graduate when they talked about plastics, how they lied to us like the way they did about tobacco. Anyways, what we've done, my partner and I, we've built a series of gardens, flower gardens and fruit gardens in our yard. So we don't have to go to the farm, to the table. The farm is in our own house. Right now, we actually have had meals that we've grown in our own yard. Plus, we have a way of recycling the stuff you use from the food that you don't use and stuff like that. We compost it and then use that compost to make garden fertilizer our own. So we have done a lot of these things so we can make a little bit of sustainability in our own neighborhood, in our own yard.
It's great to hear from you, Steve. And he's talking about composting. And, you know, we could tackle that right now. Ryan, in your work with Zero Waste New Hampshire, what have you observed about composting recently with the pandemic? And more broadly, how much does the leftover food that our caller talks about, you know, just end up in the trash?
Well, composting is the hottest topic in the zero waste group because everybody is realizing that they're throwing so much food in trash. And I think it's something like 40% of all food in the grocery store also ends up in a landfill. And one of the biggest issues in New Hampshire is that New Hampshire does not have the regulation around industrial composting of meat and dairy, which would allow for municipalities and private companies to pop up and allow composting on a larger scale. So it's totally on the consumer and the citizen to figure out how to compost in their backyard, in their apartment. There's different through this network in the group, there's some people that are going to other people's houses to pick up their compost to feed their chickens. People are just trying to figure out how to do it because right now New Hampshire doesn't have a system in place to allow for it. And there are third-party companies that have popped up out in the seacoast, but they're bringing the compost into Maine because Maine allows composting on this industrial level. And then there's a company in Nashville called City Grows, and they're bringing it into Massachusetts to compost. And then there's Upper Valley Compost, but they're bringing it into Vermont to compost. So it's a little bit bizarre that there's all these people that want to compost and there's companies popping up, but they have to bring it out of state to actually compost it.
Interesting. And what do you think, Kirsty? You know, composting is a huge issue. We've done whole shows on it. But there is this idea that it does take up a lot of weight in the waste stream. And I wonder what you've observed.
Yeah, the food scraps and yard waste are about a third of the trash that we're throwing away into landfills and incinerators. And when you remember that New Hampshire produces about 1 million tons of waste a year and then imports another 1 million tons to burn and bury in New Hampshire, if New Hampshire said, you know what, just like Vermont, we're not going to allow any food scraps on our landfill anymore, which is what Vermont has already done. If New Hampshire took that step and then also, as Ryan said, put some composting regs in place, then what that would do would be reduce your trash hugely, but it would also push people from other states who are importing their trash into New Hampshire. It would change it so that they would be forced to compost too. So we've seen a rise in composting across the whole region, both backyard composting, which can be just, you know, can be just as, you know, Ryan was saying, you know, in your backyard, doesn't have to be real high tech, or it could be collection or cooperative with your neighborhood, as Ryan was saying, or there's pickup services in cities too. We've seen a push throughout the whole region, and those are becoming much more prevalent in Boston and all over the area. I think that's the low hanging fruit, not to make a pun. And one of the first steps that we should take to reduce our waste is to, you know, be better about eating the food and feeding animals. So as Ryan said, we're not throwing away 40% of our food, which is about what we throw away, but then also compost it afterwards. There's no reason we can't be doing that throughout New England, especially in New Hampshire.
Let's go back to our callers. And Cindy's calling from Dover. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yes, thanks. I want to talk about all the liquids we purchase that are in plastic. So I don't know if people realize that water made with a filter at home is only 10 cents a gallon versus $2 or $3 a gallon that you buy in all those water bottles. So people could do that. But also, I don't think that grocery stores provide enough juices in frozen conditions. And instead, people are buying all their juices in plastic bottles, which are toxic on any level, like you said before. How can we get grocery stores to have more frozen juices and people to understand how much better that is as a source of drink in many ways? Thanks.
Cindy, I'm glad you called. And Kirsty, when I was little, I don't even remember juice in plastic bottles. It was all sort of the frozen juice that you had to mix up on your own at home. So Cindy, thank you for calling. What do you think, Kirsty?
Well, two things. One, you know, you want to go to a store like the one that Ryan runs and make the best choices you can at a place like that. And also change your buying habits. You shouldn't buy bottled water, for instance, as the listener was just saying. The other thing is that there are ways to regulate this. There are now four different towns in Massachusetts that have banned single-serve bottled water. In other words, that single-use plastic, small bottles of water are banned in Concord, in Wellfleet, and in Brewster in Massachusetts. So the regulation can happen, and that's one of the things that we have to start doing is requiring that we have better corporate practices, and we have to do that through government. The other thing is that if you require the companies to pay for the recycling piece, producer responsibility, like a bottle bill, if you make them responsible for the end of life of that plastic bottle, then they start doing a better job with selling things, for instance, in concentrate form, as the listener was saying, or we've seen redesign where you start refilling glass bottles, which when we were kids, Laura, that's how you bought your Coke and your Pepsi, is there were refillable glass bottles. There's no reason we can't go back to a system like that, but certainly the bottling companies and the plastic companies aren't going to do that without a fight, and we're going to have to require that they do that through incentivized, not only laws, but local ordinances to make that happen.
Well, I remember when Concord, Mass passed that no small plastic water bottle bill. And Ryan, I got to ask you this, you know, when we talked about that on the exchange, I don't know, a year or two ago, we got some pushback from audiences saying, look, you know, if I'm driving through Concord, Mass and I am thirsty, I should be able to buy a bottle of water. There's kind of a freedom argument to it. If people want it, you know, government shouldn't tell them they can't have it. And if people are really concerned about plastic water bottles, then they won't buy it. So I just wonder how you sort of parse that out, Ryan.
Well, so I think this is kind of a question of the individual right versus public health. And we see this with the mask. Like, is your right to a bottled water worth the environmental catastrophe that the plastic industry is imparting on the world? And that's really what it comes down to every time you make a purchase of single-use plastic and you say it's your right to do that. Is it really worth it to say that that's your right when we see the effects of plastic pollution on the entire world? And that's how I see it.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, we did a whole show on it and we could totally work on those arguments a little bit more, but I'm going to move on because we have so many emails and calls from our listeners, including Caroline in Windham, who says, how is the online shopping surge and all the plastic packing increasing the problem? Caroline says, I take all of that plastic and other plastic film to the bin in the stores. What happens to it then? You know, I did want to ask both of you, and Kirsty, maybe you first, what trends have you been tracking at the Conservation Law Foundation in terms of people's trash and recycling habits due to the pandemic? Caroline's right. You know, a lot of people have been getting a lot of boxes on their doorsteps, online shopping.
There's online shopping. There's also people having food delivered to their home, which has been an increase in plastic for your residential recycling and your trash. On the other end of it, we've seen a real decrease in business and commercial waste. So in other words, downtown in cities and town centers where maybe everybody walked out and bought lunch and it was in a plastic container, that's not happening as much because so many of us are working from home. I also, you know, we all joke about the sourdough bread piece and earlier a gentleman was talking about his garden, which sounds like a lifeline product for him, not a COVID type project, but a lot of people have turned to gardening and making food from scratch, which again, that decreases how much plastic you're using. If you make bread, then you have plastic, you know, I mean, you really can get a lot more mileage out of your food, not only cost-wise, but also as far as your waste goes, if you make things from scratch. So it's a mixed bag. I will say that what we are seeing is increased costs for cities and towns because businesses pay for their own waste and recycling. When you're doing something at home, your city and town ends up, the taxpayer ends up paying the brunt. Either you're paying for your own trash or it's happening at the city and town level. So individuals are bearing a lot more costs of the increased waste overall due to COVID, I would say.
That's interesting. Ryan, I got to ask you too, in your work with Zero Waste New Hampshire, what have you observed about how the pandemic has affected the amount of stuff people are putting into their trash bins and their recycling bins? It seems to me there's a couple trends and counter trends here.
Yeah, I think we're all grappling with the fact that there's way more single use touches. And then there was that period of time where you weren't allowed to bring your reusable bags into the grocery store. And I know the plastic use right there just skyrocketed. So what I love about the group is it's progress, not perfection. And also everybody wants to help everybody else. So offering the suggestion of filling up your groceries in your cart and then wheeling them out to your car and putting them in your own bags. And so it's very solution-based, but it's just these one-off individual ideas that hopefully, you know, being on the show today, we'll get more than 1,000 members and we can really expand the conversation. But I think that people are just discouraged that it felt right before the pandemic, people were starting to make all these moves towards reducing their waste. And then the pandemic hit and it seems like we have single use touches everywhere that weren't there before.
So are you saying, Ryan, that the pandemic has caused a surge in single use items because people are afraid of contamination? And that it could be a while before people return to, you know, considering reusables?
I think so, because there are some people that still aren't even going to the grocery store. You know, they're having their curbside pickup. I think it's going to be a while till we see everybody back in the stores or going out of even to their house, because we do free delivery in the local area. So there's still people that don't even want to go into the store, and that causes waste.
I did that home delivery just once, just to see what it was all about. And I was surprised at how many bags they used. When I go to the store myself, I say, you know, you can fill them up pretty full for me. But there were a lot of bags there when they brought that delivery home. Let's take another call. This is Elsa in Kingston. Hi, Elsa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was surprised the other day at the grocery store to see somebody using recyclables and bags. And they told me that it's been a whole month since the governor allowed people to bring their own bags to the grocery store. And I never heard that on your station. I listen to you guys every day. Should have been a big announcement, I think.
Yeah. Well, Elsa, I'm glad you listen every day. I'm sure it was reported, but there's a lot of news out there. So it's perfectly makes sense that you missed it. And I did want to ask about that. Kirstie, I think, you know, she's right. About a month ago, the governor said you can bring your cloth bags back to the grocery store. But people have kind of gotten out of the habit. I wonder what you're seeing.
Well, it's really interesting because the plastic industry did the same thing that they always did at the beginning of this pandemic. They said plastic is what is safe, plastic is what is clean. You should be using plastic single-use bags. That's what makes the money, so that's what they're always going to push for. And the environmental community, and I think most you know, most customers looked around and said, well, wait a second, how does this virus really work? And what we found out from talking to epidemiologists like Dr. Ben Lockwin and other folks, I think he's been on your show before. What we found out is that people and we stay away from other people, which is why so many people are still not going out, as Ryan said, and why we're all being so careful. That being said, there are no recorded cases of someone getting the virus from stuff. In other words, if you pick something up, as long as you keep washing your hands, as long as you're as careful as you can be, you're going to be okay. So reusable bags are not a source of this contagion. The groceries from your grocery store, nobody's washing their groceries anymore. That's not a source of the contagion. Reusables are, and whether it's a plate at a restaurant or a reusable bag, that's not your problem, because we've already got rules in place to keep your groceries clean at the grocery store, to keep your plates and glasses clean if you go to a cafe or a restaurant outside. Those are already in place. Reusables are no more dangerous than single-use plastic goods. And in fact, as we already talked about, single-use plastics are dangerous for lots of other toxicity regions. So you should be switching over to your reusables wherever you can and wherever you're allowed to do so. Definitely your grocery bags, you should be putting your groceries back into your reusable bags. So and the science, that's not just wishful thinking. So I think it takes people sometimes time to get used to an idea and get used to new ways of doing things, but there's no reason not to push reusables in this right now. That's perfectly safe.
Elsa, thank you very much for calling, for raising that issue. A couple emails that I'll share with you before we go to a break. Tom in Exeter says, many may not remember this, but when Hood changed their milk bottles to white to block light back in 1997, recyclers complained that the white jugs were much less recyclable. Milk bottles that are normally colorless are much more recyclable because they have little to no color, Tom says. The white bottles contaminate the milk jug recycling stream. Tina writes us, I try to buy as much meat as possible from the butcher counter at Hannaford rather than all the wrapped meats in styrofoam and plastic. It may be a small thing, Tina says, but I have noticed a lot less trash in my bag. And then Sue on Facebook writes, we minimize trash by composting and keeping stinky stuff in the freezer until trash day so that our plastic garbage bags last for weeks. But I'm sad to throw away so much plastic and wonder if the grocery store really recycles the various RID coated bags that we drop off. Thanks to everybody for writing. And after a short break, we'll take a lot more of your comments. And we'll talk a little bit more about how our waste streams have changed due to the pandemic. We're talking about composting. We're talking about recycling. We're talking about trash. Join us with an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org or phone call 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, as part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Project, we're asking where the zero waste movement is now, given shifting habits and norms around the pandemic. Also, from our listeners, we've been getting practical ideas for cutting your own waste stream while saving money. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Kirsty Petchy and Ryan Visda. They both work on this issue, Ryan through Zero Waste New Hampshire and the Concord store she co-owns, Bonafide Green Goods, and Kirsty with the Conservation Law Foundation. And just before the break, I read a couple ideas that our listeners are using to reduce their own waste streams just a little bit. Ryan, how about you? What do you do on your end?
Well, one thing I would want to suggest to people, because it feels really overwhelming to hear all of this, if this is the first time that you're learning about plastics and you're thinking about it and realizing recycling isn't what you thought it was, is to do a trash audit. So you could either do that for a day, for a week, for a month. and just see what you're producing for waste and then tackle it one by one. So maybe you start in the shower and you look at my shampoo bottle, my conditioner bottle, my body wash bottle. Do I need to buy these things in bottles, or is there also a way that I can, this bottle is my last bottle that I can refill? And do that systematically through your house over a year, because it's going to be, you can't do it all at one time. It can get a little expensive at first and it can feel very overwhelming. So just start one habit at a time based on what you're doing. And that's how we start with everybody that comes into the stores. Like, where are you at in the journey and what's your next habit that you're going to build? Because it is a habit. It's a new way of living. It's a new way of looking at everything that you're consuming and where it's going.
So how do I refill? I'm just thinking about my own day by day. How do I refill a shampoo bottle?
You bring it into, there's many places right downtown Concord. There's Granite State Naturals, there's our store, and there's the co-op. There's a non-toxic refillable option that you can just go in and refill your bottle up.
So a trash audit, and one thing at a time, so people don't get overwhelmed. How about you, Kirsty?
Well, I was going to say exactly the same thing that Ryan just said. That's exactly right. A trash audit's the way to go. We actually, every fall, do a zero waste challenge at Conservation Law Foundation. You can check it out online, where we ask people to sign up, start off with a trash audit the week before, and then start, looking at new ideas and figuring out how to do things. This past year, bar shampoo is another way to go if that works for you. I like bar shampoo. I use refillable conditioner. That I haven't been able to find a bar conditioner that I loved, but if people have ideas, email them to me. I also, this past year, was able to move away from, I already did cloth napkins, but I was able to move away from paper towels for washing my windows. I used rags in the kitchen, but then wanted to move away from paper towels for washing windows and other glass surfaces in my house. So I bought some reusable paper towels, which have worked really well. But as Ryan said, it can be a little bit expensive. It can take a little bit of time. And you have to be realistic with yourself, because you could make this a full-time job to minimize your plastic and minimize your footprint, your carbon footprint. And I also think it's really important, and something we're really underscoring in our Zero Waste Challenge at Conservation Law Foundation, that you can't solve this problem by yourself. You can change your habits and do the best you can. Keep recycling, keep sorting well, really start composting. All those pieces are really important. Purchase smart. But at the end of the day, there are some things that you can't avoid and that are done really poorly throughout our society. So we need to change our local ordinances, our state laws, to protect people so that we can phase out single-use plastics, and so we can do a better job on our waste overall. As Ryan was saying, should be composting all through New Hampshire. That's a moneymaker. There are 20 times more jobs per ton for composting than there are in a landfill or incinerator. That makes money. And also, we need to do things like Portsmouth banned styrofoam. Portsmouth, New Hampshire banned styrofoam. There's no reason other cities and towns can't do the same throughout New Hampshire and stop the use of some of these terrible plastics. New Hampshire doesn't have a bottle bill. That would save cities and towns a lot of money if we had a bottle bill throughout. So there is a lot you can do in your home that you should do, as Ryan said, and I totally agree with her. And then when you're ready, if you could start a store like Ryan did, that's awesome. If you want to be an advocate like I am, that's great. Or if you want to, do something at your local level and start a composting program or get a bill passed in your state, that's huge. That makes a big difference. Or just call your city councilor or your rep or senator.
Well, speaking of cloth napkins, Lila posted on Facebook, "My family made the switch to cloth napkins a few years ago. We used to go through a roll of paper towels a week. Now a roll lasts well over a month." Let's take another call. This is Jessica in Portsmouth. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Thank you for doing this show. I just wanted to say first that I'm actually in the process of opening a refill store as well here in Portsmouth called the Refill Station. So we will be focused on household products, but our mission is to reduce our plastic footprint. And I also had a question or just sort of a comment. I was curious what your guests think about trying to buy organic products products at the grocery store that are not wrapped in single-use plastic. That's one of the most frustrating things to me when I can't get something at the local farm stand and I go there for the product and it's all wrapped up in plastic.
Oh, so even though you want to buy something organic, Jessica, it's kind of heavily wrapped up and you don't want that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to throw that to you, Kirsty.
Oh, it drives me nuts. I'll do you one better. None of that filmy plastic is recyclable. Sometimes it gets downcycled and it made into plastic decking, perhaps, but it's not going to get recycled in any of the systems through New England. But you know what drives me even more crazy? The only organic chicken at the store the other day was on a styrofoam tray. So styrofoam is very toxic. It was either a free-from chicken or the organic chicken. That was my only choice, and the styrofoam is so toxic. So what do you do? And so that's why we need to really put pressure on these corporations to do things in a different way. One of them, as I said, ban stuff like styrofoam. It's so toxic. But, you know, there's other ways to put corporate pressure on. We could do campaigns across the region on that. And then also, again, anything that you do yourself, it does help. So you make the best choices you can. And I think, as Ryan said, I love what you said earlier about progress, not perfection. Try not to drive yourself crazy with any of this, because we're just doing the best we can.
Well, here's an email from Ingrid in Newmarket, who, wow, she's doing a lot. She says, thank you for this refuse, reduce, repurpose, recycle, and rethink program. Ingrid says, fortunately, I live in the seacoast, so our compost can go to Maine. By using our commercial composting bins at our transfer station, I put out my orange Newmarket garbage bag about once every 6 months. Wow, Ingrid. She says,
great.
I am fortunate that I don't have diapers or other sanitary products to force out the garbage bags more often. What has amazed me is the reduced quantity. Yeah, I've got a composting bin, and I have to say, I put a lot of stuff in there. So that's helpful. Thank you for writing, Ingrid. Nell asks, I think it was the Conservation Law Foundation guest who said they have 5 R's to help reduce trash. She said one of them, refuse. What are the other 4? Kirsty?
Well, you know, there's lots of good R's, but refuse and reduce are my favorite ones, because if you don't use it at all, there's no impact on the environment, right? And it saves you all of that money. So that's the best one, definitely. I also really like rethink and redesign. People use them pretty much interchangeably. We want to be forcing companies to redesign their goods, and one of the ways to do that is to force them to pay for the end life of their products and their packaging. If they are forced to pay for that, then they redesign that, and we're seeing that all through Europe. And then, of course, there's still room for recycling. You want to make sure you do a good job sorting your recycling, but before you get to recycling, anytime you can reuse is one of my favorite R's as well. Reusable water bottles, if you make sure when you get in the car that you got a full bottle of water with you, you're all set. And that's really important to be, and, you know, reusable coffee cups, reusable water bottles, reusable razor blades, menstrual cups. Like, there's lots of different things you can do that are reusable that will really avoid a ton of plastic, literally tons of plastic trash through our society. Many people also include composting in the recycling category, and that's fine, too, if you want to stick to the R's. Ryan, I think you had a couple of other R's, too. Am I missing some?
Repair, and then that last one was rot.
That's right. I love repair, too. There are so many products that I know could be fixed if there was a good repair shop. If you're, you know, if your waffle iron is broken, it's probably not really broken, but there's no place to repair it. So really finding good repair shops is really huge.
Well, speaking of repair, Owen in Concord posted on Twitter, I am 14, 9 million tons of furniture end up in landfills every year. So Owen says, I recycle and flip it. Take the old and make it new. This is one way we can make the world better. I have a small business called Squid Flip in Concord, New Hampshire, where I upcycle furniture. Owen says, I think we can all do a better job of reusing and repurposing household goods. I've been in business for over 4 years now, and I know that it's going to take people in my generation to make a real difference in the world in terms of environmental action, but we need the grown-ups around us to do their part too. Owen, thank you for writing. And this gets back to partly what we talked about, Ryan, the pandemic. I think before the pandemic, a lot of people were buying recycled, you know, old furniture, repurposing it. secondhand clothing shops. People were sort of buying vintage clothing and really loving it. But now how do people feel about it, Ryan?
Well, it's hard for me to represent that because I see
people
still committed to showing up at Bonafide and still are doing everything they can. But when I step back into the real world and see just what's happening, there's still people wearing gloves everywhere, you know, single-use gloves and single-use masks. And they're not going out to stores and they're buying everything at home. So I think it's going to take a while to get us back to where we were before the pandemic in terms of the awareness around not having to have this single-use barrier around us everywhere we go.
Well, and toward that end, Ryan, you know, just to wrap up with you and Kirsty, what's the sort of message you want to leave with people in this time? They may want to do a little bit more for the environment, but they are nervous about, you know, sort of the germ factor, the fear factor.
I would say start small and just look at, you know, one room at a time. How can you make a difference with not bringing single uses? Just start small and one step at a time.
Kirsty, how about you? Your last advice for folks.
I totally agree. Don't stop recycling. Definitely keep sorting your number one, number two plastic, your metals, and your cardboard and glass and putting them in your recycling bin. Number two, do the best you can shifting to reusables and avoiding plastic and other single-use products. And then take action in your community. Form a recycling committee. Call your select people. Call your state reps and senators. Take action and, you know, write a letter to the editor. All of that matters. Call into a show like this. It makes a huge difference. So this is a problem we can solve, and we can not only protect the environment and public health, but save money while we're doing it. So let's get together and do it.
Kirsty, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Laura. Thanks, Ryan.
That's Kirsty Petchy with the Conservation Law Foundation. Ryan, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Jessica Hunt.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.